Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight we journey to Munich in the 1930s, where music, champagne, and candlelight mask a far darker undercurrent. A glittering evening turns suddenly to tragedy, and Hercule Poirot must step into a world of secrets, jealousies, and betrayal, where every gesture on the dance floor may conceal a motive. This is The Last Dance in Munich, written by us in homage to Agatha Christie. The tale takes its inspiration from the Lola Montez affair of 1847 in Bavaria, when the arrival of a beautiful and scandalous dancer threw court and country alike into turmoil. Yet the story you will hear tonight is entirely our own invention. Before we begin, tell me in the comments, where in the world are you listening from this time around? Your answers always delight me, and I do spend time with each one, often replying as well. It's your presence that makes this little community feel alive. Creating these stories, writing, narration, and illustration takes many hours, and your support is what allows us to keep going. You can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive content, or leave a small tip if you wish. But know that your listening, your comments, and your shares are already a wonderful way to keep Nocturnal Tales alive. Now, the band strikes its final chord, the glasses fall silent, and the mystery begins. Chapter 1. An Invitation with Orchestra. There are mornings when even the most civilized city slips its collar and goes larking like a pup. Munich, as I first saw it that May, had scrubbed its pavements, spread a sky of improbable blue, and set about being delightful. Cafe tables sprouted like white mushrooms. The citizens looked as though they had personally ironed the sunlight before wearing it. And Hercule Poirot, my friend, and if one must be honest, the true reason I am admitted to interesting houses, declared himself content. "Ah, Hastings," he said, tapping the carriage window as our taxi rattled down the Maximilianstrasse. "Behold the geometry of a city that respects symmetry. See the boulevard, wide, ordered, exact. It is a place where even the pigeons would not dare to walk diagonally." "Pigeons usually lack Euclidean ambition," I said. Poirot turned a mild eye upon me. "Nevertheless, they offend." We were bound for the Hotel Vier Jahreszeiten, which had given Poirot a suite with balconies and me a room with a window that could be persuaded to open if you first made your peace with several bits of pre-war carpentry. This, I need scarcely say, was entirely appropriate. Poirot thrives upon balconies, while I am fundamentally a creature of drafts. Our presence in Munich was due to one of those letters which arrive with a crest at the top, and a tone that suggests the crest has written it. Sir Andrew Forsyth, attached to the British Embassy, had requested Poirot's discretion and attendance at a gala to be held that very evening in aid of something both laudable and indefinite. The restoration of a chapel, I think, or the preservation of some frescoes from the attentions of time and schoolboys. What interested Sir Andrew was not plaster, but people. Specifically, a dancer whose name had become of late the refrain of Munich gossip. "Lila Montrose," said Poirot, inspecting his moustaches in the glass of the lift as though the lift had been invented solely for that purpose. "A name that is not German, pas du tout." "Irish by birth," I informed him, repeating what I had read in the morning paper. "Or English. No one seems quite sure. She dances slightly too well for some people's comfort, and with slightly too many admirers for anyone's." Poirot's eyebrows lifted together like cautious shutters. "And with one admirer in particular." "The papers say Baron Friedrich von Albrecht," I said. "Steel, railways, and a melancholy palace." "Rich men," said Poirot, "are like large cheeses. They attract the mice." "You disapprove of cheese?" "I revere it, but I keep it covered. At the hotel, we found a note from Sir Andrew requesting tea at 5. Until then, Poirot arranged his brushes as a general arrays cannon, and I, having no brushes of consequence, went out to be improved by architecture. Munich obliges. I was improved by a church, a bridge, and a very small pretzel that pretended to be larger than it was. Returning, I discovered Poirot not only perfect, but pleased, which meant, I knew, that fussy battle had been waged and won against something man had foolishly thought finished. "Observe," he said when I entered. He drew back the curtains. The view, obligingly, presented the street in so composed a fashion that one could almost hear the paving stones counting themselves. "It is very straight," I said. "The world," said Poirot, "is tolerable when it is straight." At 5 precisely Sir Andrew arrived, being the only man I have met who looks born in evening wear, even when he is just in a lounge suit. He greeted Poirot with genuine warmth, and shook my hand as though checking if it rang true. "Montrose," he began when we were settled and the tea had consented to be poured, "is the stage name. Eliza Monaghan by baptism, later Eliza Montrose, then Lila when Paris told her to be. She has the sort of face you remember and the sort of past one edits."
"Ah," said Poirot, "the scissors."
Sir Andrew smiled.
"Precisely.
She has enthralled our friend Baron von Albrecht, who is at the very respectable age at which men become deeply irresponsible. He is rumoured to be arranging an annuity and a small town for her, metaphorically speaking, though Bavaria has quite a few small towns, and the Baron is accustomed to owning things."
"What is the trouble to the embassy?" asked Poirot.
"Moral panic. It does not usually write on embossed paper."
"Quite," said Sir Andrew. "Ordinarily we would content ourselves with pursed lips. But Montrose has a habit of collecting letters. Men write remarkably foolishly when they're impressed by a pair of eyes and the idea that they are interesting. She then becomes very businesslike about those letters if a relationship sours. There's talk of certain correspondence from a British industrialist who is, inconveniently, negotiating with the Bavarian ministry for a large contract. If a scandal were to explode this week, the minister would fall upon his sofa and pretend to be made of principles."
"Blackmail?" I said. Sir Andrew stirred his tea, which was a shame for the tea. "The word is melodramatic. Let us instead say, the young lady is practical." Poirot regarded the embassy man with an expression of polite scepticism.
"And you invite Hercule Poirot to a charity gala to watch a dancer be practical?"
Sir Andrew shifted, not used to being shifted. "I ask you to observe without being observed. If matters appear to be moving towards an indiscretion likely to splatter British interests, I would be grateful if you would dry clean the moment."
"Tiens," said Poirot softly. "You wish me to be the small umbrella that prevents a large embarrassment?"
"If you like."
"And if there is nothing at all to be done?"
"Then you will have spent an evening in Munich with good champagne," said Sir Andrew, with the melancholy of a man who has frequently been obliged to make do with champagne. Poirot assented graciously, and Sir Andrew departed with the air of one who has placed a valuable parcel on a shelf, and is now hoping the shelf was well made. We dined early. Poirot insists upon it when there is dancing, on the grounds that the human digestion and the Viennese waltz are by nature enemies, and then took a car to the ballroom, which belonged, as nearly as these things ever do, to everyone. I have seen handsome rooms, and this was one of them. Chandeliers descended like patient comets, mirrors multiplied one's better features, and there was a dais for the orchestra, upon which men in white ties pretended not to care that they had the power to make everyone move. Munich society, which can do an excellent imitation of Vienna when it tries, had assembled in pearl and starch. The Baron was pointed out to me discreetly by three different people who used the same discreet tone. He was tall, spare, and had the pallor of a man who does not often go outdoors for fear of meeting opinions. His daughter, the Freyin Helene, accompanied him, a clear-eyed girl with a modern mouth and a dress that could have committed any number of sins and still been forgiven. Of Lila Montrose, there was, at first, no sign, but like any seasoned performer, she permitted anticipation to do its costly work, and then appeared precisely when the evening had reached the pitch at which the entrance of a star seems the most natural thing in the world. She came with laughter around her like a retinue. Dark hair,
the black of good coffee, skin that reflected candlelight as though it had studied at it, and a gown of green that argued persuasively for the existence of green as a moral good. One felt, even at a modest distance, the particular electricity that attaches itself to certain women and runs up loose trousers. I had not intended to be impressed. I had also not intended to be 28 again. Such is life.
"Steady, Hastings," murmured Poirot, who possesses a sixth sense for my more vulnerable enthusiasms. "You droop the eyelid. It does nothing to assist your aim."
"I wasn't aiming," I protested, and then remembered that I was. Montrose danced once, lightly, as if explaining to the room that its floor had been intended for that purpose all along. It was a number of the modern sort, a little scandal for seasoning, but nothing that would trouble a duchess. Afterward, she made a small tour of conquest. She spoke to the Baron, who became at once 6 inches taller and a good deal younger, to his daughter, to the minister of something significant, to various wives whom she charmed by an air of delighted apology for being the person everyone had come to see. If she collected letters, I thought, she did so with the air of a woman collecting compliments out of kindness. Sir Andrew drifted by like a conscientious cloud. "All well?"
"For the present," said Poirot.
"Good. Keep it so.
If only life would take instructions."
Chapter 2. The Last Polonaise. There are two ways in which an evening declines. In the English fashion, it becomes heavy at the wings and droops respectfully towards the floor. In the continental manner, it develops an appetite and proceeds to eat itself. This evening chose the latter course. The champagne grew more intelligent. Laughter decided it had been right all along. The orchestra discovered it could play faster than morality. I, who have been known to waltz without incident, took a turn with a lady who regarded me with gratitude and concentrated entirely upon not crushing my toes, a task in which I regret to say she failed nobly. Poirot danced not at all. He stood, genial and compact, and permitted the room to throw information at him. A word here, a glance there, a small movement of a hand that suggests a man has lied. It is a performance requiring the patience of a saint and the malice of a cat. After an hour, he had apparently determined which of the gentlemen present were actually gentlemen and which were merely in evening clothes.
"Come," he said at last, "we make the promenade."
A ballroom seen only from the edge resembles a theatre viewed from the street. We moved through the anterooms, which had been designed, very sensibly, for the recovery of breath and the exchange of unwise remarks. In one of these we passed Lila Montrose in low conference with a young man whose hair had taken sides against his common sense and largely won. Montrose was smiling with her eyes and not with her mouth, a dangerous arrangement. Poirot's head inclined a fraction. He did not pause, but a small note I knew had been made in the ledger of that excellent brain. We found the terrace. The night outside was pure advertisement, the sky attentive with stars, air the exact temperature at which one may forgive a city its excess of marble. Couples walked the length of the balustrade with the purposeful indolence of those who have things to say and are deciding to say them later. Below, in the garden, the lanterns had been strung as though a family of prudent moons had come down for a visit.
"Beautiful," I said.
Poirot agreed. "And useful."
"How so?"
"In a beautiful place, people relax their guard. They assume that truth will be as agreeable as the view, and so they confide. Observe. There, near the orange tree, the Baron speaks with his daughter. He remonstrates. She replies with the economy of a person who has a budget and intends to keep it. He gestures. Eh bien, the gesture is of helplessness. And now, regard, Mademoiselle Montrose is about to join them." She was indeed. She came out with a light little shiver, unnecessary, I think, but becoming, and the Baron turned to her with that air of proprietary rapture that makes young women angry and jewelers rich. Helene watched the enchantress as one might watch a very pretty match held too close to a very old curtain.
"Baron," said Montrose, with a voice pleasant enough to please itself,
You promised me the Polonaise.
The Baron became a man who remembered the Polonaise as an oath. At once, he said. Hélène, with admirable coolness, took a step back. Enjoy it, she said, and politely did not add, Do try not to burn down our lives. They passed within a yard of us. Montrose's perfume went by with her, something very faint and expensive that managed to be frank and mysterious in the same breath. She did not look at us, which was the most careful looking she could have done. Hélène's glance, on the other hand, rested upon Poirot for a brief instant, with the directness of someone who recognizes competence and files it for future mischief. We returned to the ballroom as the Polonaise gathered itself. There are dances that flatter old men. This is one. The Baron moved with a dignity that instructed his knees. Montrose followed with the amiable obedience of a victory. I have never quite understood why watching other people dance can be so absorbing, but it is, and was. Perhaps it is the knowledge that sooner or later someone will tread upon fate. If this were a moral tale, the tread would have come at once. In life, the shoe sometimes takes its time. There were toasts and a brief interlude in which a tenor made everyone's hair feel inadequate. At length, the supper hour approached. People who had sworn earlier that they would never eat again were reunited with themselves and looked younger. It was then that a small disturbance began at the far doorway, of the sort that excellent servants quell by existing. A waiter, too young to be excellent and therefore honest, came through with the expression of a man bearing a piece of rather important news, and only later remembering he is not supposed to have any. He approached the master of ceremonies, whispered, received a strangled whisper in return, and was dispatched towards the corridor with instructions to combust discreetly. Poirot was already moving.
Come, Hastings. Where?
To the place from which the waiter has been forbidden to return. We slipped out by a side door and into a passage that smelt of flowers and dusted velvet. Beyond lay the dressing rooms and a series of little salons where ladies rearranged their weapons and men pretended not to practice expressions. We met the young waiter, now perspiring in a manner that suggested a punctual conscience.
Monsieur,
said Poirot in that tone which causes people to remember their mother's better advice, you have been summoned to fetch whom?
The commissar, sir, he stammered. They sent for the police.
Fräulein Montrose, she...
Yes,
said Poirot very gently. She has fainted, I think, said the boy, with the eagerness of one who longs to have misseen, in the private retiring room behind the stage. She does not wake. Poirot glanced at me. We will accompany you, he added, as if discussing the weather. It is always as well, Hastings, to verify the diagnosis before the doctor arrives. We entered a narrow corridor lined with chairs that had known better conversations. At the end, a door stood ajar. Within was a pleasant room appointed in cream and gilt with a sofa too delicate for reality. Two ladies hovered there in a flutter of solicitude and calculation. On the sofa lay Lila Montrose. I have seen fainting. It is rarely neat. This was very neat. Her head was turned in the way painters prefer. One arm had found the position clever women reserve for bracelets. And her face, well, her face had the pallor of a sheet of expensive paper. Poirot went to one knee beside her, an extraordinary concession on the part of his trousers. He did not touch her at once. He looked, he listened, he breathed as though he were borrowing the air from the room for later. Then he took from his pocket a little silver case and from the case a pin. "Forgive me, madame," he said, and pricked the soft flesh of her forearm with the faintest of touches. Nothing happened. He rose with the gravity of a man who has been introduced to the inevitable. No, he said, she does not faint. The two ladies released in unison a small fashionable scream. I have always thought that if women must scream, it is considerate of them to select a matching pair. Send for the police, said Poirot to the waiter, though the boy was already halfway to the task. And for a doctor. And closed the door.
No one enters who has not the right. Do you comprehend?
He did. The door was closed. The room became very quiet, very quickly. Even the music outside, which had been going about its business cheerfully, seemed to take a step back and listen.
I looked at Lila Montrose and at the small smile her lips had somehow retained. It was not the smile of a contented woman. It was the smile of a woman whose last thought had been of victory and who had been corrected.
Poirot glanced around the room. There were flowers on a small table, white roses with the vanity of angels. There was a cut-glass atomizer, a compact, a fan that would have flirted even if shut. There was also a glass, half-drunk with the faintest ring of lipstick like a stolen secret.
"Do not touch," he said mildly, when my hand, traitorously English, made a movement of tidying. "We will allow the disorder to speak."
"Poirot," I murmured, feeling the old chill rather unwillingly oblige, "you think—"
"I think, mon ami," said Hercule Poirot, and his eyes were very bright and very hard, "that Munich has made itself beautiful this evening to distract, and that a murderer has taken advantage of the good manners of the room."
He looked once more at the still form upon the sofa, at the terrible neatness of it, and added with a softness that was more terrible yet, "The last dance is finished." And thus, with the orchestra playing something extravagantly cheerful on the other side of the wall, the curtain rose.
Chapter 3. The Roses and the Letters.
The Germans, I have noticed, are admirably thorough even in their excitement. When a calamity occurs in London society, people drift about murmuring, "Shocking, shocking," while their eyes sparkle like Christmas. In Munich, by contrast, calamity produces a kind of efficient dismay. The men button their coats more tightly, the women draw themselves up as if disaster had been included in the program, and waiters suddenly look as though they have studied military drill. Such was the effect when word went round that Lila Montrose had fainted in a manner incompatible with waking. The ballroom did not at once collapse into chaos. It swayed like a ship considering a storm. The orchestra, with a heroism worthy of Waterloo, continued to play. Indeed, I am convinced half the guests waltzed longer than usual, lest it be thought they were the sort of people who left a dance merely because someone had died. Poirot and I remained in the retiring room while the police were summoned. The two ladies who had discovered Montrose still hovered, their sympathy divided equally between the victim and their own reputations for faint resistance. Poirot attended to the little table with its roses and its half-emptied glass, while I kept a conscientious eye on the door, convinced that at any moment the murderer would stroll back in, carrying a cigar and asking if anyone had seen his gloves. It was not the murderer who arrived first, but the commissar, a brisk man with a face that looked carved out of bureaucracy. He bent over Montrose, nodded once, and gave orders to his subordinates in the tone of a man requesting slightly hotter soup. Then he turned to Poirot and myself, with the faintly pained expression of one discovering uninvited house guests.
"And you are?"
"Hercule Poirot," said my friend, bowing with that modest grandeur he produces as naturally as others produce handkerchiefs. "You may perhaps have heard—" The commissar had. A good deal of formality melted in an instant. His expression improved from "Who are these interlopers?" to "Ah, useful furniture." Within the hour, whispers began. The Baron had been seen leaving the terrace with Montrose earlier. His daughter had been overheard speaking in tones that, translated into English, would have been filed under ice storm. The young man with rebellious hair was reported to have written poetry to Montrose, though his friend swore it was not good enough to kill anyone over. And inevitably, someone mentioned letters. Always letters. I sometimes think the entire history of Europe could be reduced to two piles, letters that should have been written and letters that should not. The guests had divided neatly into camps. Those who swore Montrose had been an angel, and those who hinted she had been an angel of a very practical kind, with wings available for a modest annuity. Neither party could be accused of indifference.
As for myself, I tried to look observant. I succeeded, I think, in looking present. The commissar was busy with his paperwork, arranging the facts as neatly as a bookkeeper arranges debts. A doctor, red-faced and discreet, had just departed.
"The roses," murmured Poirot, bending once more over the little table.
"White. But notice, Hastings, one bloom is missing. See here, the cut stem."
"Yes," I said. "Perhaps she wore it."
"Perhaps," said Poirot. "Or perhaps it was carried away by another. As a trophy, or a token." He touched the glass with its faint ring of lipstick. "And this, half empty. It may contain more truth than all the speeches of Munich."
The commissar cleared his throat. "Herr Poirot, the doctor has spoken. It was not fainting nor apoplexy. There were unmistakable signs of digitalis poisoning. A small dose, slipped into wine or water, would be enough. The lady never had a chance." He straightened, his eyes thoughtful. "Hastings, my friend, we are entering upon a dance more delicate than any polonaise. Each step must be correct, each movement precise. One false note, and the music will stop."
"Poirot," I said at last, when we found ourselves momentarily alone, "you suspect the Baron?"
Poirot spread his hands. "Mon ami, in such a case one suspects everybody, beginning with those most likely, proceeding to those least likely, and concluding with those who were not present at all. That is the order of human wickedness."
"Then you think?"
"I think, Hastings, that someone has written too many letters, and someone else has determined to prevent the next page."
And with that, Poirot turned once more to the roses on the table, as though they were prepared to testify, if only cross-examined with sufficient symmetry.
Chapter 4. Whispered Motives. The police had very decently established a cordon. Two uniformed men stood at the door of the retiring room, their expressions those of soldiers who have been posted to guard an umbrella in a thunderstorm. Within, Lila Montrose reposed in her dreadful stillness. Without, the machinery of curiosity clanked and whirred. The commissar, perspiring nobly, attempted to question guests in an anteroom, while at least 50 of them attempted to appear innocent, and simultaneously more fascinating than anyone else in the room. Munich society, it seemed, had discovered a new amusement, alibi construction. Poirot, however, had no intention of joining the queue. "We will speak to those whose names already whisper themselves," he told me. "When there are too many voices, Hastings, one listens first to the soloists." The first soloist was Helene von Albrecht. She stood somewhat apart, not as though wishing to escape notice, but as though she had calculated precisely how much notice she could endure. A girl of clear gaze, she did not flinch when Poirot approached.
"Mademoiselle," said Poirot, bowing, "permit that I condole with you on the distressing event. It is never agreeable when the gaiety of an evening is replaced by tragedy."
"It is worse," said Helene calmly, "when one has predicted it." I was startled.
"Predicted it?" She looked me full in the face.
"When you invite fire into your house, Captain Hastings, you cannot be surprised if it burns. I told my father he was being made ridiculous. I told him that sooner or later he would find himself in ruin or scandal. I did not imagine..." Here her voice faltered only slightly. "Murder." Poirot inclined his head.
"You reproached your father this very evening, did you not?"
"On the terrace."
"Yes," she said. "I begged him to let her go." She was dangerous. Not because of knives or poison, but because she would take everything from him, money, respect, friends. He smiled like a man bewitched and told me I was young and would understand in time. I told him I hoped I never would. Her mouth compressed. For a moment I felt an irrational sympathy for her, though I reminded myself she had spoken with undeniable severity of the deceased.
"You did not love her," said Poirot gently.
"Love?" Helene's eyes flashed.
You cannot love a storm. You endure it, or you flee.
Poirot made a small bow, and I saw that he had no intention of pressing her further just then. The second interview was with the Baron himself. He had withdrawn into a corner, where he stood with his shoulders stooped like a man attempting to make his body smaller than his fortune. His face, pale before, was now the colour of old marble.
"Baron," said Poirot gravely, "I regret that I must intrude at such a moment. Yet you will comprehend that questions must be asked."
"Ask, then," said von Albrecht, his voice low, "but do not expect eloquence. Eloquence has deserted me tonight. You danced the Polonaise with Fräulein Montrose."
"Yes."
A faint smile curved his lips. "I was very proud. She danced as though the floor had been built for her.
And after?"
"She excused herself. She said she was tired, wished for a glass of water, and would rest a moment. That was all. I remained in the ballroom. I spoke with the minister. He will remember. After that..." He spread his hands.
"After that, you know what was found."
Poirot's eyes rested upon him a long moment. "You loved her?"
"Do not make me answer," said the Baron. "Not here, not while she lies in the next room like a broken instrument. What I felt, it has no defense, no apology. My daughter despised me for it. Perhaps she was right. But if you are about to ask whether I killed her, I will tell you plainly, no. I would sooner have killed myself." It was a dignified statement, but I could not help noting the tremor in his hands. Poirot, of course, saw it as well. "Love may protest innocence, Hastings, but fear, fear leaves stains." The last of our trio was the young man with unruly hair. We found him pacing near a window, looking as though he expected to be challenged to a duel by fate.
"Your name, monsieur?" asked Poirot.
"Kurt Weiss," he said, with the defiance of one who has already been accused in his own imagination. "Student. At least, I was a student until this evening. Tomorrow, I suppose, I shall be a headline."
"You knew the lady?"
His face softened, absurdly young.
"I worshipped her. I was nothing to her, and I knew it. She laughed at me gently. She told me my poems were sweet but needed more commas. I would have given her the commas of the world."
"And tonight?"
"She allowed me 10 minutes. She said she could not be always serious, that men took her too seriously, and it was a relief to talk nonsense with me. I would have talked nonsense forever if she had asked. Then she left me to dance with the Baron."
"And you followed?"
His eyes blazed.
"No.
I am not a spy, monsieur. I went back to my friends. They will tell you. I drank too much champagne, that is all. If that is a crime, then I am guilty. But I did not." His voice cracked. "I did not touch her."
Poirot regarded him kindly. "Courage, mon petit. The truth will be seen."
We left the young man trembling by his window, his hair more mutinous than ever. Out of nowhere, Sir Andrew Forsyth appeared, looking like a man who had been asked to apologize for the entire empire and was considering it. He drew Poirot aside.
"This is a disaster," he murmured.
"If Montrose had truly gathered letters, well, their appearance now would finish certain delicate negotiations. The English industrialist was, indiscreet. If such a letter were produced..."
"You suggest, then," said Poirot softly, "that she held a weapon more powerful than beauty?"
Sir Andrew's mouth tightened.
"Exactly.
I was with the ambassador all evening, barring a brief interruption. But for heaven's sake, Poirot, I cannot be seen to give testimony in this matter. It must be solved quickly and quietly." He excused himself at once, leaving behind a faint odor of politics and worry. Near the doorway, a stout woman in black hovered with the air of one both excluded and indispensable. She was introduced to us as Madame Klein, Montrose's dresser.
"She was not easy to serve," the woman said bluntly when Poirot addressed her. "Too many admirers, too many enemies. I told her it would end badly. She only laughed."
"And tonight?" asked Poirot. "I brought her her wrap after the polonaise. She waved me away. After that, I was in the servants' corridor. Ask anyone." I sat by the stove. Poirot inclined his head. "You noticed nothing else?" Madame Klein hesitated, then gave a little sniff. "Noticed?" "I notice everything. She was in a strange humor tonight, restless. She kept asking me whether the flowers had arrived. White roses, she said. Very particular. When I told her they had come, she asked if there were exactly 12. I counted them myself. There were. Later I saw her looking at the vase again, frowning as though the number mattered. And now," her eyes darted towards the retiring room, "now you tell me one is gone." Poirot's eyebrows rose a fraction. "Just so. And of the guests, did anyone come near when you fetched the wrap?"
"Yes,"
Madame Klein said after a pause. "The English gentleman, Sir Andrew, you call him, he was in the passage, speaking low to one of the waiters. I thought nothing of it then. But I remember because he stopped speaking as I passed, and smiled too quickly. That sort of smile a man uses when he does not wish you to remember his face." She folded her arms, plainly unwilling to elaborate further. But in that moment she had given us more than all the champagne-soaked chatter of the ballroom, a vanished rose, and a glimpse of secrets exchanged behind the velvet curtains. Chapter 5. Trays and Timetables. The anteroom, having exhausted its supply of shock, settled into that comfortable industry society adopts when a scandal obligingly provides homework. The commissar took statements, the statements took liberties. Poirot, who distrusts both, proposed a tour of the regions in which truth is usually mislaid, corridors, cupboards, and people who are paid to notice things. We began in the service passage. It smelt of starch, metal, and secrets. A maître d'hôtel of priestly gravity presented himself as Herr Blum, guardian of cutlery and order. "Monsieur le maître," said Poirot with a bow appropriate to a bishop of spoons, "we require the movements of your staff between the polonaise and the unhappy discovery." Herr Blum produced a ledger as square as his jaw. "Runners assigned. 2 to the ballroom, 1 to the terrace, 1 to the private rooms. Names, Carl, Emile, and, Otto Fink for the retiring rooms." "Otto Fink?" repeated Poirot. "And where is this paragon?" Blum pursed his lips. "Momentarily unfindable." "A useful talent," I murmured. "Not at all useful," said Blum coldly. "Merely intolerable." A pantry boy was dispatched and returned with gossip, as pantry boys do. Fink had been seen near the back stair with a tray and a look of terrible purpose. After that, he had developed the invisibility common to men who have done something or think they have.
"The tray," said Poirot. "What was upon it?"
Blum consulted the ledger again. "1 carafe of water, 2 flutes of champagne, 1 glass with orange liqueur." Poirot inclined his head.
"The carafe of water, at whose request?"
"The Baron von Albrecht," said Blum. "He told a waiter that Fräulein Montrose required it." "The champagne was a general order. Ladies in waiting, perhaps. The liqueur was requested by no one in particular. Fink said he added it because it was fashionable."
"Eh bien," murmured Poirot.
"So a tray with 3 drinks goes into the retiring room. 1 carafe, 2 flutes, 1 glass, and presently we find only 1 glass with lipstick, half drunk, beside the lady who is now dead." We examined the sideboard. A row of clean glasses beamed their innocence at us. Beside them, a solitary flute waited with the sulkiness of the uncollected. Poirot lifted it delicately, sniffed, and made a small face. "Orange liqueur, yes, and something faint and bitter beneath. Digitalis announces itself only to those who listen." He set it down very carefully. "We will not touch further. Let the police have their satisfaction. Herr Blum, whose soul I suspect was a receipt,
produced a small brass bell pull register showing call times. A neat row of dents marked when the retiring room bell had been tugged. Three tugs between the polonaise and the alarm, the last exactly 5 minutes before the waiter had summoned the commissar. "Three calls," said Poirot softly. "One to order, one to deliver, and perhaps one to regret." From the pantry we progressed to the little retiring room once more. The roses had not improved their story by repetition. Poirot studied the vase, then the little cut stem. "Regard, Hastings," he said, offering me his pocket lens. "The cut is very clean, fine and straight. A florist's knife makes a slant, a gentleman's pocket knife makes a wobble. This is the work of small, sharp scissors." "Madame Klein would have scissors," I said. "Dresser's habit." "Naturellement. And so would any lady intent upon the rescue of a stray thread." Poirot glanced at the compact on the table, opened it with a fingertip, and examined the puff. "Colour, a rose that leans to coral. Yet the lipstick on the glass is a deeper crimson. Two shades in one evening? It is possible. Or," he closed the compact, "two mouths." The commissar, arriving with the gravity of consequence, informed us that a search for Otto Fink had been rewarded by a door found open to the service yard and a cap found abandoned on a crate. "Flight," he pronounced. "Perhaps fright," said Poirot. "There is a difference important to the man who flees. We were conducted, by the air of a man doing us a favor he would later regret, to the servants' corridor. The stove, Madame Klein's chosen throne, radiated both warmth and opinion. Its neighboring bench held a litter of the evening's survivals, a menu card, a broken fan, an empty chemist's envelope crushed to the size of a lie. Poirot smoothed the envelope. The printing declared Apotheke Thal, Odeonsplatz. The writing, a neat feminine hand, read Tinct Strophanti. I raised my eyebrows. "Not digitalis." "A cousin with similar intentions," said Poirot. "And in tincture, easier to conceal, easier to decant." The commissar made a noise suggesting promotion might be possible after all. "We will go to this apothecary." "Alas," said Poirot, "apothecaries will speak in the morning. Tonight they sleep and dream of labels." He turned the envelope over. A smear of pale green grazed the paper. He looked at it, then at me, then at nothing at all. "Hm." We returned by way of the passage where the waiters loitered like junior conspirators. Poirot selected one, a freckled youth with the expression of a boy who had recently remembered a rule. "You served the retiring rooms?"
"No, sir."
"Only the ballroom." "Then you will certainly know who did, because great knowledge is strictly forbidden to those who possess it." Poirot smiled. The boy capitulated at once. "Otto, sir." Otto took a tray with water and a liqueur, but he said the lady had asked for champagne too. He put the extra flute and went by the long way, past the anterooms, because the short way was crowded.
"The long way," said Poirot. "Past whom?"
"The English gentleman, sir, and the baron's daughter." They were speaking with different faces. He coloured. "I mean, sir, they were not speaking to each other." Helene and Sir Andrew, two faces, two roots, one tray. Back in the anteroom, society was still industriously arranging its innocence. Helene stood as before, cool as the opposite of fever. Sir Andrew had acquired a newspaper from the previous week and was pretending to read it with historical interest. The Baron sat breathing like a man who had climbed a very long staircase. Kurt Weiss stared at his hands as though they had betrayed him. "Hastings," said Poirot quietly, "we possess now the bones of a little program." A tray with three drinks, a bell pulled thrice, a waiter who walks the long way, a rose cut with small scissors, a glass with a lipstick not in the compact, and an envelope that tells us our murderer purchases prudence by the dram.
"And which of them?" I began.
Poirot raised a finger. "Patience. We will ask the florist to confirm the roses and to whom they were delivered.
We will ask the apothecary who bought the tincture, and when. We will find the missing Otto, or we will let his absence speak. Above all, we will invite these good people back to the ballroom. The scene, it is important. Murderers are like actors. They cannot resist the stage.
He looked once more at the little room with its terrible neatness, the fan, the compact, the glass with its treacherous ring, and gave a small, satisfied nod.
The music is ready, mon ami. We will call the dancers.
Chapter 6. The Final Step. The ballroom had emptied of gaiety and retained only its guilt. Guests sat stiffly in little knots, each rehearsing an innocence they hoped would be believed. The commissar planted himself like a magistrate, moustache bristling with civic duty. Sir Andrew held his chin at an angle usually reserved for portraits. The Baron looked 20 years older than he had at supper. Hélène stood very straight, her gaze fixed on something far beyond the chandeliers. Madame Klein folded her arms like a woman prepared to outstare eternity. The commissar presided like a judge waiting to pronounce sentence. Herr Blum loomed in the background, polishing his ledger as though it were the Ark of the Covenant, and the suspects, if one may call them so, stood in a line of discomfort. Poirot advanced a few steps, no bigger than a chess piece, yet in that moment he dominated the board. "Mesdames, messieurs," he said, bowing, "the time has come. The ball is ended, the music is silent, but the last dance must still be performed, the dance of truth." I could not help a little shiver. When Poirot begins to sound like scripture, it is usually because he intends to deliver judgment. He turned first to the Baron, who sat with his head bowed, his long hands clenched like pale roots. "You, Baron von Albrecht, you are guilty, ah yes, but only of the oldest folly in the world. You ordered water for her. You looked upon her as though youth could be purchased at the florist's. You sent the roses. But poison, Baron? No, you tremble too much for that. You left the errand to a waiter. You never touched the glass. You are blind, not murderous." The Baron made a strangled sound, but said nothing. Poirot's eyes slid towards Kurt Weiss, who looked ready to recite either an ode or his last will. "You, mon pauvre poète, you worshipped her with your pen. You were mocked kindly, yes, but mocking does not drive to the apothecary. To poison requires patience, calculation, coldness. You had champagne, not calm. Your guilt is of commas, not of crime." The boy gave a sob of relief, his untidy hair quivering like a banner of surrender. Poirot's gaze moved to Sir Andrew. "You feared letters, did you not?" "Always it is letters." "You whispered with a waiter you dreaded scandal. But you are an Englishman of diplomacy. Your weapons are delay, discretion, denial. You drown in documents, not in tinctures. You are innocent of this, at least." Sir Andrew's ears flushed, but he gave the faintest of nods, like a man who has been spared a duel. Poirot turned to Madame Klein. "And you, madame?" "You had the scissors, yes. You counted the roses, yes. You sat by your stove, muttering, perhaps. But you are a woman of blunt speech, not of delicate poison. You told us what you saw, and for that we thank you. But you did not kill." Madame Klein folded her arms even tighter, sniffing as if acquittal were no more than common sense. Poirot's voice sharpened. "So who remains?" "Let us consider. Mademoiselle Montrose died by digitalis. The tincture was purchased at the Apotheke Thal, the envelope written in a feminine hand with the smear of a green pencil. A woman's purchase, a woman's hand, and then the roses. 12 delivered, 12 confirmed by Madame Klein. But when I examined them, there were only 11. One cut neatly with scissors. Why? Because it was used to mark a glass. The tray contained several drinks, water, champagne, liqueur. How to ensure that Montrose chose the poisoned one? By setting a rose beside it, an ornament any woman would assume intended for herself. She lifted that glass. She drank. And she died. A ripple of unease stirred through the room.
I confess it unsettled me as well. The idea of death marked by something as innocent as a flower chilled me more than daggers. Poirot's finger stabbed at the little table where the fatal glass had been placed. And here the lipstick. On her compact coral, on the glass, a darker crimson. Two mouths touched it, first Montrose, then another, who raised it with her in a false toast, pretending reconciliation, leaving her own trace upon the rim. Two colors, two women. That is the detail the murderer forgot. I caught my breath. Until that moment, I had not realized how damning such a small difference could be. Poirot wheeled. His eyes, green and brilliant, fixed upon Hélène von Albrecht. You, mademoiselle. You quarreled with her on the terrace. You saw her triumph, you saw your father humiliated. You possessed the scissors. You met the waiter in the corridor. You cut the rose. You marked the glass. You lifted it, letting your own lipstick mingle with hers. And when she faltered, you pulled the bell thrice. Order, delivery, regret. Voila, the rose, the lipstick, the envelope, they all point to you. The Baron half rose, anguish in his voice. Hélène! Together, and when she spoke, her voice was hoarse. Yes, I did it. I killed her. She would have ruined him. She laughed at him, made him ridiculous. He is my father. Do you not understand? She would have taken everything, and he would have let her. Better she die than see him destroyed. She swayed, then steadied herself. I only meant to frighten her. A little sickness, a warning. But when she raised the glass with the rose, when I saw her lips touch it, I knew. Her voice broke. I knew it was too late. The Baron covered his face and gave a cry that silenced the room. Sir Andrew looked away, uncomfortable even in pity. Klein shook her head as though the whole thing confirmed her lowest opinion of mankind. Poirot bowed, very grave. Mademoiselle, poison never warns, it kills. The commissar gave the signal. Officers stepped forward. Hélène lifted her chin and walked proudly between them, refusing to look at her father. The Baron sank back, grey as his fortune. Sir Andrew folded his newspaper with fastidious care, as though order might keep scandal at bay. Poirot smoothed his moustaches with infinite delicacy. Hastings, mon ami, it was all there. The rose, the lipstick, the bell, beauty and death together. One must only see which shade does not belong. I shivered. The last dance, Poirot. He inclined his head. Yes, and it is finished. Epilogue Departure. 2 days later, we left Munich by train. The station clock looked down on us with the solemnity of a magistrate, but the pigeons on the roof treated the whole affair as a comedy. Poirot, who mistrusts both pigeons and German timetables, regarded them with equal suspicion. We depart, Hastings, in perfect symmetry, he announced, arranging our luggage as though it were troops on parade. Two trunks, two valises, two tickets. All is in order. I glanced at the morning paper folded under his arm. The death of Lila Montrose had been reduced to three polite sentences, the arrest of Hélène von Albrecht to a rumour, and the charitable gala was reported as a glittering success. Munich, it appeared, had tidied away its scandal as briskly as it polished its pavements. You know, I said, I still cannot fathom why Hélène drank from the same glass. Poirot's eyes twinkled. It was strategy. A gesture of intimacy, of confidence. Mademoiselle Montrose would never refuse such a toast. And in that moment, the lipstick betrayed the truth. Murderers, Hastings, are always betrayed by vanity or by colour. I prefer plain beer, I muttered. Poirot ignored me, his gaze fixed ahead. Sir Andrew will report to London that nothing of consequence occurred. The Baron will retire to his estate, where he will grow old in melancholy. And the world will forget the dancer who waltzed once too often. But we, his moustaches bristled with satisfaction, we shall remember. The whistle shrieked,
The train lurched forward, and Munich began to slide away, its rooftops retreating like scenery pulled off a stage. I looked back until the last spire was gone, and then forward, where Poirot already sat with his egg-shaped head shining beneath the carriage lamp, content as a man who has proved once more that the smallest details, roses, lipsticks, bell pulls, are enough to bring down the grandest illusions. And so concludes The Last Dance in Munich, a case where gaiety gave way to shadows, and beneath the brilliance of the ballroom lay a truth as cold as the Bavarian night. This story was written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, inspired by the real-life Munich scandal of 1931, yet entirely original in its telling. If you've listened until now, then you are the reason these stories continue. Thank you for being part of this growing community. Your encouragement, your reflections, and your thoughtful comments make sharing these mysteries such a joy. I take time with each one, and I try to reply whenever I can. If you'd like to go further, you can join our membership or leave a small tip, but know that simply by being here, listening, and sharing, you are already giving more than enough. Until our next mystery, good night.